Archery Podcast. All the latest news, interviews, tips, and techniques from the world of field, 3D, and target archery. Hit the X with the Barebow Archery Podcast.
So I'm joined on the line by Jens Fudge, archer, mental training coach, and author of the book Choose to be a Winner. Welcome to the podcast, Jens. How are you? Are you good?
I'm all right, thank you. I've just been out shooting, actually.
Have you?
Oh.
We're not allowed to, so I'm very jealous.
That's why I told you.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. It's like all these picture people... putting pictures on Facebook.
We have restrictions, but not as bad as you do.
Yeah.
We're allowed to be 10 people at a club.
Yep.
We have to wear a face mask while we're unpacking our gear and while we're packing it back together again.
Yep.
But while we're shooting and collecting arrows, we don't have to have a face mask.
Oh, right. Weird.
I don't see the logic in there, but someone probably does.
Yeah. There's always someone who thinks it's obvious and logical, but to the rest of us, it's maybe not.
If, however, we have a youth training something, we're allowed to be 50 people.
All right.
So we can have a group of 50 people if it's a youth training.
We're in not total lockdown. We are in lockdown, but you can still go out for exercise and to go to work. But it means that the basically people are indoors, you know, most of the time. So I've got a family in at the minute.
I'm in my office. I'm self-employed. I'm the only person in my own company, so I've got this small office. I went to this small office space for this interview because it's much easier.
Yeah, yeah. I've literally got a kit cupboard under the stairs, and that's where all the gear is. I'm just going to grab a quick swig just before we start. Welcome to the podcast, Jens.
Thank you very much, and thank you very much for having me here.
Yeah, no problem. We were happy to get you on. We've seen you. We've used your training manual, and we've seen other people on European Barebow Archery Group using your book. So I thought, well, what better to do? There's not a lot of archery going on in a lot of places at the minute. People can't shoot. So maybe doing something on the mental side of it, you know, could help people along. So tell us a little bit about yourself, where you live and what you do, you know, related to archery and within archery, and where we can find out a little bit more about you and the book that you've got out, Choose to be a Winner.
Well, yeah, I live in Denmark. I live on a small island called Fyn, which is kind of the middle island if you view a map of Denmark. And English speaking people always get amused by the name of the town I live in, which is, the name is Middelfart. And that is actually the name of the town where I live. We do not have an upper fart, and we don't have a lower fart. We only have a middle fart.
I can understand why. I can understand. My kids would be laughing for about 20 minutes now if they knew that somebody lived in a place called Middelfart.
That's actually where I live. So, yeah. And what I do related to archery, well, I've been involved in archery since 1987, where I started off shooting. And I packed shooting in about 96 because work and family and stuff like that took over. But I didn't ever pack in being a judge. I've been a judge since 1988, and I've been judging competitions ever since then. But I also, around 10 years ago, started some mental training workshop for a group of young kids who asked me to do so because they thought this could be fun. Having known that I did quite a lot of mental training when I was shooting myself. And then a couple of years ago, that's 2018, it's hard actually to remember exactly when, because all of this COVID stuff is going on. You don't have a grasp of what's going on when or where. So, but anyway, a couple of years ago, a friend of mine, Dennis Bayer, asked me if I wanted to help him coach some kids going to the youth championships of the Nordic countries. So that's Faroe Islands, Iceland, Finland, Sweden, Norway, and Denmark. So yeah, sure, I'll do that. And then I've been doing some mental coaching ever since that.
Sounds cool. Excellent. I must point out to our listeners that you speak English like a native, and there's a reason for that, isn't there?
There is, yes. I am not a native English speaker, really, but my dad was English, and I've never actually lived in England. I've been to England a couple of times to visit family, and my family is from the Somerset area. I lived in Germany and Norway, and we went to English schools until I was around 10 when we moved to Denmark. So that's probably why I speak more or less good English. Although when I'm surrounded with English people, they tend to know that and can feel that I'm speaking English, but they cannot grasp my accent, where it's from.
Yeah. It's kind of strange. Now you say there is a little bit of kind of the Southwest, but also kind of a little bit of London, kind of home counties area in your accent. So yeah, it's I was kind of a bit perplexed when we first kind of we spoke. So yeah. So as an archer, kind of what level were you at and what level did you compete in?
Well, as I said, I started archery in 1987, and that's when I picked up my first bow, and I never put it down. I actually just left, almost literally kept in my hand for a very long time. So I thought this was kind of the coolest sport that you could actually do. Now, I have to also say that I am disabled. I've got bad feet, like really crappy feet, but so I'm eligible for competing at disabled tournaments. So in 1987, that's when I picked up my first bow. And in 1990, I went to the World Championships. So I competed at the World Championship level there, and I became number 7, shooting really bad. I couldn't get anything to work. I thought I was going to be quite good at these championships, but I found out that everything that I did didn't actually work, and I was getting frustrated and all that stuff. I did end up number 7, which isn't bad or anything for having shot for 3 years and going to the World Championships and then being...
Yeah, not bad at all, not bad at all.
No, not bad at all, but I really felt that I could have done better because my scores were plummeting. On the way home, I was trying to figure out what went wrong, and I found out this must have been something going on in my head. So that's when I started with all that mental stuff. So in 91, I went to the European Championships and took the gold.
Oh, excellent. Very cool.
Quite easily, actually, taking the gold there. And in 1992, so 5 years after I started shooting archery, I went to the Paralympic Games and I took the gold there too.
Oh, nice.
So that was kind of the highlight of my career, as so to speak.
So that's the Paralympics, the kind of Paralympics that we know a lot more about these days. That's that kind of the Paralympic event within the kind of IOC Olympics.
Yes, it is. It's held by IPC, the International Paralympic Committee.
Okay.
But in of course, very, very close collaboration with IOC. And it's always, nowadays, it's always held in the same city as the Olympic Games.
Yeah.
And then it's 2 or 3 weeks after the Olympic Games finish, then the Paralympic Games start. So we always say, as disabled people, that's because that the city needs a practice run first to make sure everything is working before they have the real thing.
Excellent. So the Olympians are just like the kind of warm-up act.
Yes. They're just there for making sure that every volunteer gets to learn what they're supposed to do, when they're supposed to do it, and all that stuff.
Yeah, excellent. It's like the kind of the act that just comes on before the main act, and that, you know,
yes,
they make sure
exactly.
that, make sure
and
everything's running more. Smoothly. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
Excellent. So, I mean, that's kind of a high level, do you think?
That's kind of the highest level you can get. Yeah.
So in those events, you must have been under pressure and going from, you know, being disappointed with the seventh earlier on in your career at the World Championships, and then going to the Euros and the Paralympics and then taking the gold. Something must have changed then.
Something did change, because when I got back from the World Championships, what I did is I headed straight to the public library. That's for kids these days don't know what that is, but this is something that dates pre-internet. So we have big buildings where you could get dead tree copies of ebooks. Yeah. So they're naturally printed. They're printed in paper and stuff, and you have to go to the public library and borrow them. And then I borrowed all of the books that I could find about mental preparation for competitions. And there was one in particular that was really good. And it was written by a Norwegian psychologist, sports psychologist called Willy Rilo. And he wrote a book that is called Best When You Need It. So whenever you need to be the best, that's, best when you need it.
Yeah.
So that's the book that I kind of more or less worked my way through. But what I found is that it was kind of hard, because he was a sports psychologist, and I don't think he's ever been under pressure at any sports competitions himself.
Yeah, I hear that. I hear that there is a lot of criticism of some of the kind of sports psychology is that, yeah, this is all great in terms of theory and stuff you do in a classroom, but
yes,
you need to have experienced it yourself. It's kind of like being a sex counsellor but still being a virgin.
More or less, yeah.
I'm kind of like, maybe you're not giving somebody the best advice there. I know at the same time there are, you know, practitioners at a high level in all kinds of sports, pastimes, kind of work. And despite the fact that they're a high-level practitioner, they can't actually relate what their experience is to people, you know, further down the food chain is kind of a very rough term. But, you know, people who are hoping to ascend to a higher level, and they can't communicate that. So, I mean, there's, you know, there's extremes there. But when you yourself have been under pressure and in competition, and then you learn about this stuff, do you think that validates and you put it into practice as well? Do you think that obviously validates the things that you know and the things that you teach a lot more?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, because the psychology approach of writing a book is, well, I would say whatever I read, it's probably 100% accurate. A lot of the stuff, however, is something with big words like prefrontal cortex. And I don't give a rat's about prefrontal cortex, whatever. I want to know how to hit the target. So
yeah, we all do.
I don't really care what the chemistry is about the psychology area of which part of the brain does what part of the shooting act or something. I want to know when the sports psychology said, oh, you have to visualize. Okay, how do I do that?
Yeah.
So it's the practical approach that I want to know some more about. And being on the target field myself, and I've been under pressure loads of times, I feel quite confident that I qualify very much for knowing what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's good to have that experience. I mean, a lot of the people that I've read or spoke to, I kind of respect them a bit more, because they're putting into practice what they teach, and they kind of live by what they teach. Whereas I've been pointed in the direction of certain books. Oh, you need to read this. It's about like peak performance, but it's more of an academic study. And it's kind of semi vague. There's obviously a message in there, but I think you probably need to be an academic and then refer to some of the case studies and some of the peer reviewed material to get an understanding. Whereas, like you say, you don't need to know what the prefrontal cortex is or which chemical or which part of the brain processes, you know, thoughts, motor programs, all that kind of thing, you kind of need a more practical application.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
That's exactly on the point, yeah.
And so you got involved with the mental side because obviously on a personal level you wanted to improve your archery, essentially your kind of your mental toughness, your mental approach, you know, being more, things being more predictable for you and you being able to control them when you're under pressure. So when did you get involved in it in terms of maybe coaching or and what made you kind of decide to write the book and what actually is, you know, mental training and what is Choose to Be a Winner, the book and the website that you've got? What is all of that about and what was the kind of motivation behind that?
Well, yeah, that's kind of a big question, but I'll see if I can answer all of the aspects of that question. But whatever made me start into getting this, into coaching other people, because yes, as you said, when I first started learning about mental preparation, it was for my own benefit only. So later on, and this is around 2010-ish, a group of young kids asked me if I wanted to have a workshop for them, teaching them a little bit about mental training and visualization and what it's all about. So I had a small group of, I think we were around 10 young, upcoming, good archers, one of them actually being Danish girl Maya Yeager, who won the World Championships in 2013. I don't think it's only because of me. Maybe Coach Kim Yong-tak from Korea also had a bit of that stuff there going on. And of course, she did actually pull the string herself and shot the arrows. So
yeah,
so
maybe, yeah. We'll give her a bit of credit for that.
Yeah. So anyway, I just forgot about it until 2 years ago when a friend of mine asked me to help train these kids going to the Nordic Championships, where in particular, one thing stood very, very clear to me was that when we were at the Nordic Championships, and I've been mental coaching these kids for almost a year, we met around once or maybe sometimes twice a month, where I would take them through a lot of steps on how to mental do this and how to mental do that. And then one of the girls, her name is Kit Lohmann, she shoots the longbow, which is, I can't believe that anyone can hit with a longbow. I mean, I couldn't hit the barn even if I were in the barn with a longbow, because I mean, there's no cushion plunger and the arrows are made of wood and you got 3 arrows but they're not the same. They're almost the same, but they're not the same. And you've got feathers on them instead of plastic veins. And I'm really impressed that people can hit anything with that stuff. But at the gold final, the score that was 4-4 between Kit and another girl.
Yep.
And well, the last end of this gold final at the Nordic Championship, and I can bet you that she was under pressure.
Yes.
She actually shot 2 X's and a 10. With a longbow,
yeah,
meters distance. That, how can you do that?
You've shown me the picture, and those arrows are almost touching.
So, they are.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable. So
yeah, yeah, and under pressure as well. Gold final.
Yes, exactly. And kind of to top it off, she broke her wrist, so she was shooting with her, you know, with her arm in a plastic cask. So, She won the Nordic Championships, and we had a couple of other archers also winning gold medals and performing very, very well at these championships. So I decided that more or less at that point, okay, I'm going to write kind of a leaflet or a pamphlet about what is this about. And when I reached around page 20, 25, I kind of rephrased it to be a book.
Yeah, so it kind of gone past the stage of being a little handout, and you're like, well, I'm halfway there, so I might as well carry on.
Yeah, exactly.
In terms of your interaction with you with the archers that you've you know, you've had interactions with in terms of the mental training side, I mean, what happens on those sessions? How do you go about it? And you know, what kind of things do they study? Is it very basic stuff? Is it really, do they have to go away and do some kind of diploma in mental training, or what kind of way do you do it?
Well, we try to make a kind of practical approach. So when we do have these training sessions, Dennis Beyer and I, he will teach them more about the technical stuff about shooting and making sure that they start correctly. So start with a warm up, start with shooting on a bear butt, and then maybe go in some different techniques about how to put your shoulder and all that stuff. But we also have a lot of theory. So, and all of the theoretical stuff is, well, most of the theoretical stuff is probably me teaching them something about the visualization stuff and the mental approach of this. So I'm trying to get them to realize that you need to have a positive attitude at whatever, it's a training session or a competition or whatever it is. You know, you need to maintain a positive attitude to whatever you're doing. And I remember one of the training sessions we had, I said, we were just talking, we're having lunch, and I said, I've figured out a good way to throw off the competition, because when there's a competition and there's a final, you could just stand behind your competitor and kind of tell them off and say, oh, you stink at shooting and you're really bad. And all of the kids here, they were horrified, and they said, well, no, you can't say that to anyone. And I said, well, yeah, of course you can. You can say that to your opponents and maybe even your mates, your teammates, because wouldn't that be fun? No, that would be horrible. And I actually got them to explain to me why that would be horrible in talking negatively to other archers. And they all agreed that this would have a bad impact on motivation.
Yeah, yeah.
So I turned around and said, well, why do you do it to yourselves then when you're out doing the competition and you shoot a bad arrow?
Everyone, you see, it's the kind of, you see it on the line, don't you?
Yes. So, and then they started thinking, oh, yeah, I actually do tell myself off when I shoot a bad arrow. So that's one of the things. And then I get them to sit or lie down, and then I do a relaxation, kind of a more or less a hypnotist kind of thing, but without being hypnotist. So I just talked them through relaxing, talked them through breathing, talked them through a lot of making sure that they're relaxed and comfortable. And then I try to get them to visualize a point in their full jaw, or it could be visualize letting their loose go properly, or it could be visualizing being at a competition with an opponent. You've got you're at the finals, and maybe you're at you're shooting against a strong opponent, or maybe you're shooting against a weak opponent, and you have to kind of be aware what can go wrong and what can go right, so you are more or less prepared for this stuff. I also talk to them about if you're nervous, what can you do about your nervousness? And a lot of people, a lot of archers ask me, well, how do I get rid of being nervous at a competition? I said, well, I don't know, because you don't. You do not get rid of being nervous. You accept it. You embrace it. You kind of feed yourself the energy that the nervousness is, instead of thinking, oh no, I'm so nervous because I'm going to compete against, let's say it's in next year at the Olympic Games, and you're going to compete against Brady Ellison. Who's not going to be nervous competing against Brady Ellison at the next Olympic Games? He's kind of pretty good, as I believe.
He's half decent, yeah. He's half decent.
Yeah, he's kind of pretty good, right? So why wouldn't you be nervous? But there's actually no reason to be nervous. But you can, instead of being nervous, you can kind of say, hey, I'm at the peak. I'm actually shooting against Brady Ellison. This is top notch. So instead of being nervous and being kind of intimidated by him, you can turn that around and say, I feel really, really good because I'm shooting against one of the best archers in the world. And I'm doing that because I am one of the best archers in the world.
Yeah, so you're flipping the kind of anxiety on its head.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think that's important. I mean, there's been another recent podcast or a couple of recent podcasts from The Push with John Winker, and I think that's the approach that he uses, where he takes the kind of nervous energy and he uses that to kind of make himself excited. And
yeah.
There's a similar feeling between that kind of Christmas morning when you were a little kid and Santa's just been, and mm-hmm. there's a very similar feeling of butterflies in your tummy, jelly legs, kind of all shaky and nervous and excited and excitable, kind of uncontrollable. Mm-hmm. And it's a very fine line between that and anxiety and having jelly legs and being nervous and worried. It's just,
yes, exactly. Yeah.
It's just a, it seems to me it's just a perception. It's just a perceptive difference in that in one mm-hmm. situation, it's a positive, you're excited, you're hoping you're going to get really good presents for Christmas. And in the mm-hmm. other, you've got exactly the same kind of feelings in your body, but you're kind of terrified. So it's kind of flipping that on its head. And like you say, if you are in the final up against Brady Ellison and all you're thinking about is Brady Ellison and not, I deserve to be here because I'm in the final with Brady because I'm at that level, you're kind of, you're not thinking about your own game.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and I saw a good meme somewhere on the internet that winners think about winning and losers think about winners.
Yeah, that's a good one. Yeah, losers aren't thinking about winning; they're thinking about their opponent.
Yeah,
yeah, that's a good one. I've never seen that one. That would be a good one to repost at some point. So. This kind of visualization and kind of making, turning the kind of what people are labeling anxiety, because other people label the same thing as excitement. I mean, John Winker kind of went into this on his podcast with The Push about, you know, there are people who don't like driving fast in a car. They don't like motorcycles. They don't like roller coasters because that kind of thing terrifies them. Because they're looking at the negative aspect. What if this happens? What if that happens? Mm-hmm. Whereas other people embrace that and they actually chase that. So for them, maybe to deal with a competition pressure, or say you're a hunter and, you know, the book of your life kind of comes walking past your tree stand. If you, like you were saying before about breathing, if you suddenly you stop breathing and you go tense, and you, instead of saying, I've got an opportunity, like gold final, and you're like 4-2 down, and all of a sudden you've got the opportunity, you've got a couple of arrows in the 10, some people might crumble, whereas some people might go, I've got a shot at this. And I've seen so many finals on YouTube, especially indoor finals, because they're just a lot easier to access, a lot easier to film, so they get the show and they're put out there. And you see someone and they're like 4-0 up, and all they need is an extra point.
Yeah.
And that's it. It's game over. But the next thing, you know, if you were to stop the tape there, you would go, well, they have it. They're 4-0 up. All they need is another point. They're cruising to victory.
Yeah.
And then 3-4 minutes later, it's 6-5, because they've either become a rabbit in the headlights, or they thought, well, I've got it done now. I can relax. I don't need to attack or, you know, be determined because I've done the job. So, in those situations, which are all slightly different, how does the mental training help with those?
Well, the mental training that I provide for the kids that we have on these training sessions, and also I distinctly remember I've put a audio track addressing exactly this moment here, that you're at a final, and maybe your opponent is in the lead, or maybe you're in the lead, and a lot of things can happen both ways, because if you're in the lead, you can, as you say, you can, oh, I've got this, I don't need to concentrate anymore. so you don't concentrate. Or if you're not in the lead, so you say, oh, there's no chance that I can ever get this. So you relax and you start focusing on your shot instead of focusing on the target, because one of the major things that I think that people do wrong is they do the qualifying round really, really good, focusing on the movements on the shooting line and letting the arrow hit wherever the arrow hits. But as soon as they get to the finals, and it might be their 4-4 or whatever they're at, now they're thinking about the target. I need to hit the 10, they think, which it doesn't work that way. You have to shoot the shot first, and then the arrow will hit somewhere. You don't hit with the arrow and then shoot the shot, if you understand what I mean.
Yeah. I overthink. That's been a problem now for about a year. So I'm kind of envisaging myself in this kind of scenario, in that initially I would shoot the shot and the arrow went where the arrow went. At the same time, I was kind of learning the skill of archery. Mm-hmm. But I wasn't outcome oriented. And when it did hit the 10, I was kind of, you know, happy, but yeah, I wasn't trying to hit the 10. I shot the shot and then the arrow went into the 10.
Yes.
When I got a little bit more experienced, I became better technically, my expectation increased, mm-hmm, to a point where I expected to hit the 10, not shoot the shot.
Yep.
So I kind of then became careful. So I started to do things carefully, and yeah, I overused my conscious part of the shot. So I went from having a kind of a nice smooth release where it just happened to having my hand flicking out the side of my face because, yeah, I was trying to get a 10. So is that what happens in these finals, where they suddenly decide, I need to get this, so they start to kind of focus on that and not, you know, what they were doing before?
Yeah, I can kind of put an analogy to it. If you have a great big cruiser ship with 250 men trying to get this ship to go from A to B, and everything is going smoothly, and you're a captain, right? You know that when we're going from A to B, you've got your 250 men doing whatever they need to do, and everything is going fine. And then all of a sudden, you decide, oh, by the way, I'm the captain, so now I'm going to decide what everyone does all at once. So it's the same with your muscles. You spend hours and hours and hours and hours and hours on the training field shooting archery. You're teaching your muscles muscle memory. You're teaching your muscles how to do this. So you consciously have to just think, shoot an arrow, and then your muscles know more or less what to do. So they will do it properly at training. And then when you get to the finals, you say, oh, okay, muscles, listen up now, because now this is important. So I'm not going to leave what you've been doing for thousands and thousands and thousands of times. I'm going to do it myself.
That's exactly what happens. Yes.
And apart from that, what I just remembered, what I really like to teach the kids, which is also stressed in the book that I wrote, there is one arrow at any given competition or any given training session that's the most important arrow there. And I ask, whenever I talk to someone, if someone comes to me, approaching me at a competition, can you help me with my mental whatever? And they ask me a question, and because it seemed to me that I get maybe five good arrows shot and then a seven and then a three or miss the target, whatever, wherever you're at, whatever level you're at, and you have five good arrows and a bad. What's going on? How can I do this? And I turn around and see if I can find any of my young kids that I've been teaching this, and I say, which is the most important arrow at this tournament? And the answer is, and they're very good, I've taught them this, and they're very, very good at answering the same answer every single time, the one that's currently knocked.
Yeah.
So whatever you have done, whatever five arrows you have shot, whatever five arrows or 10 arrows or 12 arrows you're going to shoot this afternoon if you advance to the finals, they don't matter at all. The one that's currently knocked, if you shoot that good, make sure the shot is executed to the best ability that you can, which is not hitting the 10 every single time unless you're Brady Ellison. But if you're someone else, it's hitting within maybe the red or something. I don't know. Depends where you're at your level. So if you kind of accept that, yes, when I shoot an arrow, it's going to hit within my normal standard group, then that is a good shot.
Yeah, yeah.
So if you, for example, just to make the calculations in my head easy, if you, for example, shoot 420 points for a, let's say 540 points for an indoor round, so that's on average of a 9.
Yeah.
So you have 27 points. So if you hit outside of the 9, you've kind of lost, you think. But no, not really, because your group is not 9s, because you also have some 10s.
Yeah.
So if you hit an 8 and a 10 and a 9, you still have an average.
Yeah.
So the 8 is not necessarily a bad arrow.
Yeah, and it's probably best not to focus on the 8, because all you're going to do then is get more 8s.
Yeah, and then it's going to be 24 instead of 27 on average.
Cool. So what kind and what kind of level of archer does your kind of your book and the mental training that you've done apply to? I mean, say you're someone, a club archer that's doing reasonably well and shooting in kind of local competitions, or a field or a 3D archer who's, taking part in national events for kind of team placement. National team placement, or you're a diehard bow hunter who kind of gets the heebie-jeebies and forgets what to do when that kind of big buck comes into view. How does what you do and the things that are in your book choose to be a winner? I better plug it again, just in case anyone's forgot over the last 38 minutes. How does the mental side, help them, and how does your book help them to become better? Because I kind of see a lot of people just, their attempt at getting better is to do the same thing over and over and over again. So how does, because this would be something very different for them, and maybe it would, how could you encourage them to maybe say, take some mental training or read a book on mental training?
Well, the book that I wrote is, as you also stress out, for archers competing or hunting or whatever, but it's also for any other sports, really, because whichever sport that you're doing, you can apply exactly the same techniques to golf or boxing or tennis or table tennis or whatever you want. But it's also, and this is what I find to be the best, it's also all about life. So if you can kind of apply these techniques to not only your archery, but also to your general life, then you would probably be much happier, and you'd probably be approaching stuff and letting, getting annoyed about things that doesn't really help. So, like, I'm annoyed that it's raining. Well, yeah. Would it help? No, it doesn't really help. I'm still annoyed. Okay, don't be annoyed about it's raining, but maybe you can do something about how you tackle that it's raining. So, it's raining, but I'm still happy because I have a good life or whatever. So the book is not only about archery, it's about all aspects of life. Although I have used, of course, obviously, archery as the main focus to nearly every single example that there is a book in the book.
Yeah, yeah. Choose to be a winner. That's the title of the book and your website. Is it choosetobeawinner.com? Have I got that right? Yeah.
Yes.
Just in case anyone wants to have a browse and see what's on there. There are, as you mentioned earlier, there are some free audio files that are kind of what I understood to be kind of semi-hypnosis, but not really hypnosis. It seemed to me more of a kind of a guided meditation visualization, because that's how it worked for me. I mean, I don't know whether that's a definitive, but that's how it worked for me. So, yeah, I mean, that's there if anyone wants to have a look at that. So can you actually choose to be a winner? Aren't winners just born with, like, you know, it's just a lucky accident that they've got the genes and their parents were nice, positive, you know, accomplished sporting types or accomplished business types or, you know, musicians. And mm-hmm. they've just passed that on to their children. And it's just a happy accident of kind of nature. Can you actually choose to be a winner?
Well, yes and no, because we can't all just choose to win the next Olympic Games, because there's only going to be one winner.
Yeah.
So, but we can choose to actually follow the path that will help us become the next Olympic champion. We've been talking quite a lot, and some of the things that I've come to remember just while we're talking is that a lot of archers, as yourself, you said you just started, you shot your bow, the arrow ended up where it ended up, and at some point in time you had a certain rhythm so that the arrow actually ended up in the ten ring sometimes, and more or less your group tightened. And that's the common thing about any archer, that you, if you just shoot a lot of arrows, you're going to get better and better and better. But it's kind of goes into a plateau, because at some point in time, it doesn't help to shoot more arrows. You're not going to get any better.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's when you, as you say, you start getting frustrated, because now you're trying to achieve something that your form is not. So if you shoot, let's say you shoot 500 points in an indoor round, and you've been doing so for a year, and you've been shooting 3 or 4 years or whatever, and you're not getting any better, then you start getting frustrated. Why am I not hitting the 10? And then you're trying to hit the 10, and the next time you'll end up with 480 points instead of 510 points.
Yeah, yeah.
So this is the point in time where you actually have to be focused on refining your shot, and you have to be willing to and accept that if you change something, you might have to change your anchor point, you might have to change whatever. You have to accept that it's gonna hurt in points for some time.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you're learning something new, and when you've have shot thousands of arrows to get at your level without consciously thinking about what you're doing or overthinking what you're doing, when you have done that, you've actually taught your muscles with the muscle memory that this is the way to do it. So of course, when you're trying to teach them something new, they're going to try and work against that. So you have to be consistent and then give it a real shot. So it's not if someone comes to you, I think that you're going to get a better shot, Glenn, if you put your shoulder a little bit more forward, and you try it 3 shots and it doesn't work. If you give it only 3 shots, you're going to kind of not get the point.
But, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, it takes a bit more than 3 shots in your backyard to figure something out.
Yeah. So, if you freeze because you're in the finals, or if you this big buck comes and you get buck fever and you can't shoot it, you suddenly forget what to do. That's where you have to have some basic exercises to return to. And basic exercises, a lot of people more or less snicker at what Dennis and I do with these kids, because every single training session we have them stand up on the shooting line with no bow in their hand, as if they have never been on an archery field before, and then just get them put their arms up standing in a T, turn their head looking at the target, and then take their jaw hand up to the chin, and then do that 20 times or something.
Right.
And what we does do that do? What this does is it gives you a basis of where do I start? Because if you find yourself in trouble, if you just start there, okay, I'm going to go back to basics, which is stand up, have my body shaped like a T, and then just draw the string and let it go. That is the basic stuff. If you can get back to that, then within very, very, very few arrows, you're back to your normal routine again.
Yeah, it's like an intervention for when things are going wrong, and you're either focusing on the wrong thing, or you know, circumstances have kind of thrown you off your kind of your intended path, and then you need a reset. So is that essentially your version, your kind of mental training version of a reset?
Yeah, you could call it that. Yeah, so you reset so you go back to the basics. I actually heard an Irish trainer many years ago. He told his archers that when you get to this state, there's only one thing to do, and the shot consists in Irish archery of three things. And I'm sorry, but my Irish accent is terrible. But it's pick the damn thing up, pull the damn thing back, and let the damn thing go.
Yeah. It's terrible Irish accent. sounded more like you were from Lancashire.
Okay, sorry. But that was more or less. his way of resetting. Just pick it up and shoot.
Yeah.
Don't think about it.
Yeah. I mean, recently for me, I've kind of stopped. I've got a shot process now that I've dibbled and dabbled with over a long kind of period of time. Well, I say a long period of time. I've only been shooting 3 years, so it's not that long. But in terms of tinkering with having a shot process and kind of instilling a bit more determination, because I know in one of your online audio downloads, you talk about attacking in the competition. We're not kind of just stepping back and being defensive, we're actually attacking. And for me, that kind of resonated, because it was kind of, for me, putting a bit more determination into what I was doing, which at the same time, because I was more determined, I was actually consciously going through my kind of process step by step, and the determination helped with keeping that focus. There was one shot, and I know we shouldn't remember our terrible shots, but for me, it was a little bit of a revisit to that kind of past bad times of where I was just completely vague, and I completely remember my brain just kind of being in la la land. I wasn't really thinking about anything at that point, and I started to start my kind of process. Once I get to full draw, and the arrow was just gone, and it hit the one in the target, and I was just like, and the target was only 8 meters away. So I was like, obviously that's not the best there. So let's.
That's why I have the which arrow is the most important.
Yeah.
The arrow that you shot there, you did not give it any significance at all.
Exactly. Yeah. I basically switched off. Kind of mentally switched off. There was no. Mm-hmm. There wasn't determination. There wasn't, because there was no determination, there was no concentration. So my process has only three steps once I'm at full draw. I used to kind of go through, you know, kind of hand position, arm position, shoulder position. That's kind of like beginner level. And once you've kind of shot enough shots, as you've alluded to, you don't need to do that. You know, you've got If you start to think about that, all you do is interfere with the process. That's what happens to me anyway. The kind of the subconscious has been programmed, and you've got that muscle memory, which although and I do that, don't write in. I know muscles do not have memory, but you've got those kind of connections and those kind of programs programmed in your brain. And as long as you just let it do its thing automatically, you know, it's fine. Then at towards the end of that, once I'm at full draw, there are four things that I do that stop the arrow just flying off of its own accord, kind of subconsciously. Well, my brain thinks, well, I'm near the goal now, off you go, you know, shot's done. There are a couple of things, steps that I put in there that prevent that happening. And I just was not there at that point. So that didn't happen, and the arrow went, and the result was, you know, it ended up where it was going to end up with that type of shot. And for me, I say to I've got two young girls, and I always say, like, you know, we were saying today, look, you don't learn a lot from, you obviously do learn something from victories, but you learn a lot more from things when things have gone wrong, because you get to step back and analyze it and then say, this is what went wrong. How am I going to put it, you know, put it right?
And that's what I did after the World Championships in 1990, where I was number seven. It went wrong, and I had to learn from it.
So it was that just purely mental at the World Championships? Was your technique, everything kind of down, and just you didn't have the kind of mental skills, which having the mental skills is just, you know, you train to have the physical skills, but a lot of people don't train to have the mental skills.
That is what went wrong, because what went wrong at the World Championships was that I knew actually that I had the physical skills. So I knew what a shot was supposed to feel like. But when I was there, I felt nervous, of course, because this was kind of my first international thing. And I was intimidated by having to face all of these great archers, because obviously they're great archers since they're at the World Championships. So I had the approach, I'm just little me, and they're these all great archers. I know that I'm kind of good enough to be there, and I had all my physical skills. I knew what the shot was supposed to feel like, but I was, of course, nervous. I tried to not be nervous, which didn't work. But the thing about being nervous is, just like you said, you have jelly legs, and it's almost the same feeling as being excited. So actually, there are, and without knowing which chemicals they are chemicals roaming around in your body, and they're making your sensation of feeling slightly off. So when I was picking up my bow and coming back to a full draw, it did not feel right.
Yeah. That's a common thing, yeah.
I had the wrong feel of the shot. So I tried to compensate. I tried to find my feel again, and I couldn't, because I was doing it absolutely correctly, but my signals internally were transmitting the wrong feeling of the correct setup.
Yeah.
So I had the correct setup, but my signals were trying to tell me that, oh, this is wrong, but it was not wrong. So I was trying to compensate, which I shouldn't have done, because compensating something that was actually right made it wrong.
Yeah, yeah. And this is something that I did a podcast with Joel Turner of Shot IQ, and he says that, you know, shooting in your backyard, you're not the same archer in your backyard as you are on the competition line. In your backyard, you're nice and relaxed. Everything's relaxed. You're in your home environment. There's no threat. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you can stick them in the 10, like one after the other. But when you get on the line, like you say, you get the jelly legs, the butterflies in your stomach. And suddenly you kind of, when you were saying it, I was like, this is exactly what Joel Turner said to me. When you're on the line, that shot that you feel in the backyard on the training ground isn't there.
No,
it's that feeling isn't there. The shot's there, but the feeling isn't, because, like you said, then there's lots of other chemicals flooding into your system, making that your perception slightly different. And then, like you were saying, you start to correct something that, isn't faulty. So that's, to me, the similar thing that I used to do when I overthought, is that I needed to think with my conscious mind every step, which you can't do. Your conscious mind can't process that many movements all at the same time. So it tries to do one after the other after the other, and then it just becomes this mess. So like you were saying there, on the line, your shot, you suddenly felt like it wasn't there when probably it was there.
Mm-hmm. I just needed to learn to trust myself. Hey, it's good. Just shoot it.
Yeah, trust. That's a big word. People suddenly lose faith in their kind of ability, and they suddenly stop trusting themselves.
But one thing that has helped me get back to having this good feeling, because now that you mentioned that you have a good feeling, I have in the book Choose to Be a Winner, something I feel is quite important, and that's the explanation of having a training journal. And you told me that you have actually got the training journal that I've made.
Yeah, I've got that. I use it every other day.
In the training journal, I have a small chapter called Golden Moments. And a golden moment is when you have that really perfect feeling that you can shoot, and actually you have the feeling that no matter what you do, you're going to hit the 10. So that's a golden moment. You can have plenty of other different kinds of golden moments. But when you really, really have this really nice feeling, or you mentioned Christmas before, when you're excited about what present you get when you're a kid. And I know that a lot of people, they have a memory of their grandparents, right? So you go to see your grandparents, and your grandma is cooking some really, really, really nice, your favorite dish probably, and because you're the grandson, so she has to spoil you. It's it's not only their right, they have to, it's by law. So you smell this food, and you know, oh, this is great, I'm at my grandparents, and it's Christmas, and they've given me all this food, and I'm excited, and I'm going to get all the, that's a golden moment, right? You can get these golden moments on the archery field too. And when you do get these golden moments, that's where I encourage my students to really, or the archers to really think about the and write it down. And in the process of translating my book that I wrote in Danish to English, I had help from David Martel, who had done a tremendous job. He had noticed that I, many places in my book, had written something about smelling the grass. And he said exactly the same thing. So I put his kind of note in the book too. So this credit actually goes to Dave, because when you do have a golden moment and you're outside and you're shooting really, really, really nice, pick up some grass and smell it. Because then next time you go to a finals and you need to get that feeling back, pick up some grass and smell it and close your eyes and remember that feeling. Then you have your feeling back.
So the grass is like a trigger for that feeling.
Yeah. So and the smell is one of our strongest memory triggers, I've found out later on by reading about that. So if you can smell something, that will take you back to memory lane.
Excellent. Yeah. I mean, it is. I mean, there's, for different people, work, their brains work in different ways. But like you say, for smell, for some people, is the strongest thing. And just the slightest hint of a particular aroma can take them back to certain times in their life. I mean, that's a nice little kind of niche thing to add in there. And it's something that I wouldn't have thought about at all.
But I try to get people to be conscious about their golden moments.
Yeah, and I think the training journal for me, I've got a performance kind of record, which is a slightly different beast. It's more about, you know, shooting, scoring arrows, seeing where you are, how it felt, that kind of thing. Whereas I use your journal, which, is it available on your site, or is it available? Because I think I got mine off Amazon.
It's wherever you can buy my book, and on my website, choosetobeawinner.com, there is the site is in English and in Danish, and in the English part, there is a list of wherever you can get the book, but there's also most of the places you can also get the training journal as well as the book. But the training journal, you could, even if you want to just grab the PDF, I've put the PDF online so that you can just grab the PDF and print it out yourself. But I honestly believe that would be probably more expensive than just buying it off of Amazon, because I've set it to more or less the printing cost. So it's, as if I remember correctly, it's £5 for the training journal.
Yeah, bargain. Well, I mean, I use mine. At the minute, I can't shoot. I've got an injury to my to one of my fingers on my draw hand, which I don't want to make any worse than it already is. It's kind of healing up, but it's been very stubborn. The last little bit of the healing process is taking a lot longer than it did the first time that I did it. So I'm not shooting, but what I am doing is I'm doing kind of bow training reversals with what most people refer to as a form master. It's not a form master. It's a Astra archery kind of shoulder thing, but it's the same kind of thing, just so my kind of the feeling of drawing the bow and the shot and all that kind of thing doesn't go away. I'm also using a very light stretch band as well, just to work on my form in front of a mirror. But all of that gets recorded in the training journal, just so I've got a record of what I've done, how many days a week, how regular it is, you know. Because if you don't have a record of what you've done, you're just guessing. You know, if you do a lot of, I'll probably get emails about this, but you know, you do get people who say, "Well, I want to be this. I want to be a winner. I want to be like winning competitions. I want to be on a national team. I want to shoot in internationals." And then you say, "Well, what are you doing about it?" "Oh, well, I shoot like once a week down the club." And you're kind of like, yeah, it's not going to happen for you if that is...
Or even I shoot five times a week down the club.
Yeah.
And you're still not going anywhere.
Yeah. And then, so what else do you do other than just shooting arrows at a target? Oh, well, you know, I think that's the best way to get my scores up. And it's that there's so many other things involved in doing any sport. And you look at, you know, I spoke with a guy called Maurice Duffy. He kind of does motivational stuff with elite athletes and CEOs of like Fortune 100, kind of Dow Jones, DAX, FTSE companies. And offline, he told me exactly the kind of things that they go into. And it's a lot of it is not about basically repeating the sport that they do, because they already have the subconscious skill. They're already at a kind of national, international level. They know how to shoot. They know how to kick a ball. They know how to hit a ball, or, you know, do the pass a pass, or that kind of thing. They know that. That's not what is separating them from the guy who's taking the big prize money home, you know, every other week. It's these other things that he kind of talked about, you know, the meditation, mental training, the training routine that he uses, gets them to record their moods, the moods before and after, similar to the kind of thing in your book, which was, I'd never seen that in a book before, of recording your mood before, during and after training. So that in itself was all interesting, and that it kind of led me to believe that for me, because I'm kind of time poor with having my own business, being away a lot, I spend a lot of time in hotels, I spend a lot of time driving on planes, you know, that kind of thing. And I don't get to go down to a club and shoot on a club night and just stand in a field and spend 6 hours flinging arrows. So I have to work on other things, you know, to kind of mitigate those kind of deficiencies in the thing that I do. So I was very interested in what he said about, you know, working on the mental side of it, making sure that you're confident, making sure that you're aware of your skill level and the things that you do and the things that will take you up to the next level. So the journal itself for me is that kind of, it's basically a recording of what I've done, where I've been and where I'm going to. It kind of gives me, you know, if you're not recording this, you don't know where you are on your journey, and you don't know, you know kind of where you want to be, but you don't know, if you've not recorded anything, where you are in relation to that goal.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how it works for me, and I probably have to buy a new one because I've filled it up already.
Well, go ahead. Yeah. Buy a finished one.
Yeah.
As I said, I put the price on the training journal as low as it will go for just only covering the printing costs, so that's fine. So I just want to help people with this training journal, and it's of course when I actually made the training journal, I did it as an example so that people could download the example and see what it was like. And then I thought I might as well just publish it as a book on Amazon also, so that you can go ahead and buy it from Amazon and get it properly in a book format. So, but if you feel, anyone feels that this training journal has a lack of something or too much of something else, that's fine by me. Just use it as inspiration and, you know, use whatever you can instead. And that actually also goes for my book, Choose to Be a Winner, because not every person acts and reacts in the same manner. So, maybe some of the stuff that I write in the book, you think that's a lot of rubbish, and maybe some of the stuff is better, but I kind of try to get people to have their own opinion and see what they can use. I read a very wise quote: "If you're following someone's footsteps, you'll never get in front."
Very true. Very true. You kind of have to make your own path.
Yeah.
So. Yeah. Yeah. Excellent.
So I try to get people to make their own path here, and if they can use something from a book, that's absolutely fine. And I honestly believe that every person, especially every archer, will learn at least something from the book. I know that even Rick McKinney, I don't know if you actually know Rick McKinney, because you said you've only been shooting archery for 3 years, but Rick McKinney was one of the United States top archers for many years. He won the world championships around 8 times, I think, back in the 80s and 70s and 80s.
So he knew what he was doing, do you think?
He knew what he was doing, yeah. And he was at 4 Olympic Games, missing the 1980 Olympic Games because that was in Moscow, and the United States decided to not go to Moscow for the Olympic Games. So he could potentially have been for 5 Olympic Games. And he read my book, and he ordered 50 copies of them after reading my book to hand out to his club.
Oh, excellent. Oh, well, that's an endorsement. That's a very good endorsement. I have actually got, just behind the microphone, I have got Rick McKinney's book, Simple Art of Winning, I think it's called.
He has got a book with a title like that, yeah?
Yeah, yeah. I think I was talking online with him because I wanted to buy it direct, but in the end I would have had to have ordered a few copies to cover the postage, and I ended up getting it from another retailer, which was a shame because it was nicer to deal with the author directly. Excellent. Just remind everyone again, just before we wrap up, because we're getting up to the hour mark now, so I don't want to keep you too long from being out in the rain, maybe. Tell the listeners where they can find you and, you know, your website and your books, what they're called, and how they can get hold of them.
Well, finding me must be quite easy because I'm actually the only person in the world called Jens Fudge.
Is that true?
That is true. I am the only person in the world with that name. So finding me is kind of easy. And I pronounce the name Jens in Danish because it's a Danish name. I am Danish. A lot of people, English-speaking people, will say Jens because it's J-E-N-S.
Yeah.
And that's my first name. And then my last name is Fudge, which is obviously from England. So if you look up Jens Fudge on Facebook or LinkedIn or whatever, then you would probably be able to find me. I have a couple of passions, one of them being archery. So you can find some archery stuff if you search my name, but you might also find some programming stuff. Just skip that if you're not a programmer. So I put a lot of YouTube videos about programming. Different. Just skip that stuff if you're more into the archery bit of me. And then my website for archery is this book here, is choosetobeawinnerinoneword.com. And if you want the English version, just hit the English link there is when you get to the site, because the main page is in Danish. So you could also just flip the auto translate thing, but that might sometimes give you some weird results, because I actually had an American archer ask me why is anyone afraid of stains, right? And it turns out that if you auto translate the Danish word for target panic, you'd get fear of stains. So I said I have no idea why anyone is afraid of stains. We figured it out. She had an auto translate going on, so Google Translate or something made it quite funny there.
Yeah, but I keep seeing one called it translates from Spanish as I can't remember what word it is now, but it keeps calling like a barebow archer a goalkeeper. It always calls him a goalkeeper for some reason. I've no idea. No idea why.
Yeah. Sometimes auto translate doesn't work, and sometimes it does, but whatever. And yeah, on choosetobeawinner.com, you can find the downloads that I've made, the audio tracks that they're in various steps. So get the first one first, because that's just going to help you how to relax. And then I've got some breathing exercises and stuff. And they're all free, and I don't care in that respect if you buy the book or not. The audio tracks are still free. Of course, I do care if you buy the book, because that gives me some money so I can buy these Christmas presents for my grandkids.
So they can have that kind of jelly legs.
So they can have this feeling. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's all there on the website, and there's links to where to buy the book.
Yeah.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much, Jens. It's been lovely to speak with you. You've got the rest of the day to get on with. It's unusual for me to do a podcast at this time of day. Normally it's like 8, 9, 10, 11 o'clock at night when the kids are in bed and people are up and awake and moving about in the USA. So it's been a bit of a holiday for me, this one.
Oh, that's good.
Cool. Excellent. Well, thank you much for very much for coming on, and I wish you all the best, and hopefully we get some more winners thanks to your book and your audio files.
Well, thank you very much for having me, and keep them all in the gold.
Produced and presented by Glenn Pringle for Redstone Productions Limited.